One of the preachers that I follow on Twitter tweeted this past week. When you're around the preacher, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can be used as a sermon illustration. And just ask my kids. That's absolutely ask Art. You know, last week I started with the church and clowns story that he told me. And this week I'm starting with something somebody else said last week. They said that after the service was over and some of the things we talked about, they said, you know, I was part of one of those 12-step groups for a while, and I got to, just within weeks, feeling closer to those people than I do to a lot of people at church. I've heard other people say that before. I've heard people say that, church is not nearly as helpful in my daily walk and struggles as my AA group. Why is that? Because you see, church and AA are kind of built on some of the same principles. Don't we believe that we were powerless to deal with our sin and overcome our sin? And don't we believe that there's a higher power, God, that has to save us from that? Those are the first two of the 12 steps. And a lot of the other of the 12 steps sound a lot like, well, I started to say like church, but maybe like church ought to be. I think the reason that sometimes we don't feel like a church works as well is that AA is really good at building community. Everybody there is there because they recognize their need to be there. They recognize a common enemy and they want to be a common help to one another. Nobody puts on airs. Nobody tries to pretend that I'm soberer than you. Everybody recognizes that they need help. They need and sometimes church is not quite that way. And not only that, people in AA are open and willing to sponsor other people and to be there at all hours of the night to run and meet somebody for coffee because somebody is having a... And sometimes church doesn't feel exactly the same way. Well, we've been talking about in this series called Restoration Revisited, what it means to be the church of the New Testament. Last week we talked about forms and formats and how sometimes we're, you know, interested in restoring, looking like the worship of the first century church or having the organization of the first century church, largely focusing on external forms. But what we're trying to do in this series is to get us to look a little bit differently, that being the New Testament church is not doing Bible things in Bible ways. That in reality is impossible. We hardly do anything exactly the same way they did in the first century. But we're trying to capture the same power and the same passion that drove that first century church. And so we go back to the book of Acts and we start looking at different things that marked that church. And the thing that we're looking at this morning is fellowship. One of the things that the early church devoted themselves to, we looked at this text very briefly last week, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the fellowship, actually to the fellowship, literally, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. They devoted themselves. The Greek word there actually means, could literally be translated, keeping on, keeping on. It's a continual devotion to be devoted to a thing. So they continued steadfastly. That's what the familiar King James says. And one of the things that they continued steadfastly in was fellowship. Sadly, for a lot of us, fellowship means green bean casserole. Fellowship means eating together. I remember back when I was a youth minister, we had these fellowship visitation groups that would meet together for a meal, and then they would go out and visit or do something together, kind of like what we're trying to do with the small groups. And so one of the groups was just going to meet really quickly after church and then go do get their assignments of who to visit. And so the guy that made the announcements announced it this way. Group number 3 will meet down front following services today, but there will be no fellowship. Okay, get a card and don't say anything. You know, what he meant was there's no food, which really takes the fun out of it, but we kind of equate the two. But in the New Testament, fellowship, koinonia, it's the word from which common comes. It was common unity, community. That's what the word meant. It's a sharing, a participation And those words are actually used in our English translation. Sometimes koinonia appears. We are not just in fellowship that we talk to each other after church. We're in fellowship that we are in a community. We have a common unity. And sometimes the church doesn't do well. Sometimes we don't look like the first century church did. This morning, let me just mention that if we're really going to be serious about restoring the community, the fellowship of the first century church, that one of the things that are mentioned here that they're devoted to in that first church, well, then there's two things that we need to have on our mind. The first one, if we're going to restore the fellowship of the New Testament church, then we need to be a people that are marked by love. Love is to be the designation that we are to get to when we identify ourselves, when we see ourselves, we are to be not just a community, but a loving community. The New Testament talks about this. Put it this way. Sometimes right before communion, whoever is doing the table talk will read one of the passages about the what we call the institution or putting in place the Last Supper, right? And so sometimes it's Paul's version, a lot of times, most times. It seems like every week we go through, somebody's going to read 1 Corinthians 11, right? And then sometimes it's Matthew or Mark or Luke, but nobody ever reads John. Because you see, John's version of the Last Supper doesn't have bread and wine in it. What it has is a basin and a towel. Because the setting that John gives as the Last Supper, he never really tells about the supper. We already got that from the synoptics. What he tells about is Jesus washing the feet of the apostles. And he takes a towel and he gets down on his knees and he scrubs their dirty, stinking feet. And he does that because he's trying to teach them a lesson. Now remember, this is in the context of the Last Supper. Our reading this morning is from John chapter 13, verses 13 to 17.
You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Very truly, I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them.
Okay, the point of Jesus is kind of interesting. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we understand that the Last Supper is there for us to replicate every week. But when Jesus tells the story of or shows us the example of washing feet, he's not telling us replicate this every week in a formal format way. We're not supposed to have foot washing. Everybody's supposed to take off your shoes and your socks, and we're supposed to wash each other's feet. That would be okay. But the point is, he's telling us...
Somebody
listen, if you've got dirty, stinking feet and you need them washed, see one of the elders right after service. They'll be happy to take care of that. What he's telling us is that we should have the kind of, we're to do what he did. We're to show love and service to each other, just like Jesus showed love and service to the apostles. If I, your teacher, have done these things, you better be ready to do these things. Now understand, this is in the context of the Last Supper. A little bit later in the same chapter, he's going to say, the time has come. And then he's going to repeat that a couple verses later. And then he's going to show us a couple of things that this kind of love and service to one another about. In verse 34, he says, first of all, it's about a new command. A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. Okay, now this is kind of confusing if you really think about it, because he's already talked about the greatest command is to love God, but the second greatest command is to love one another. He quotes that from Deuteronomy chapter 19. By the way, if you want to check it, that's the same chapter, Leviticus 19 rather, that's the same chapter that has the command not to shave the side of your beard or not to get a tattoo. Isn't it kind of interesting? That's an old verse. That's in the Old Testament, right? So why would he say that's a new command? Well, look at it this way. Suppose I tell you that I just got a new car. What would you think? Well, the first thing you would think, of course, is that you're paying me way too much. The second thing you might think is, oh, he went down to the dealership and he picked out a brand new 2019 car. He got a new car. Or you might think that I got a 2010 Ford, because that off of Craigslist, right? That would be new to me, and we often refer to something that's new to us as a new car. Or you would probably think, because you know us, that Lynn got a new car and I got the old one, but to me it's a new car. But suppose I said, I got a new car. It burns air for fuel. The inside is bigger than the outside, and it flies. But you see, that's a new car because it's never been seen before. And when Jesus says, I'm giving you a new command, what he's saying is, I want you to love one another as I have loved you. Don't miss the point there. He's getting ready to show his love how. He's going to the cross. He has prepared them twice in this same paragraph. The time has come. But now I'm giving you a new command. You're supposed to love each other. You know that foot washing thing I did? That's just the tip of the iceberg. You are to love each other so much that you are willing to lay down your life for each other. Now, wait a minute. How can I know that's really what he's saying? Because that's what John, who also wrote the Gospel of John, says that he said, 1 John 3, verse 16, this is how we know what love is, that Christ laid down his life for us. Well, that makes sense. And then he says, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. And then he explains how we lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. We run and give them a microphone when they need it, right? If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? We are to love as Christ loved us, which means lay down our lives for each other. That's more than just a casual, how you doing, as we pass each other in the hall before church. But he says that it's not just about loving each other. That is, as we show the love of Christ, it's to be the mark of our discipleship. It's not just a new command; it is the absolutely essential command, right? He says, "By this, everyone will know that you're my disciples if you love one another." Every preacher, including me, until I threw all my old sermons out, has a sermon somewhere entitled Marks of the True Church. And then they probably got 5 or 7 or 12 or 144,000, some biblical number of points that shows what the church has to have to be the true church. It has to have the right worship. It has to have the right organization. It has to have the right name. Even though that's pretty not quite so clear in the New Testament, because not only is the church called the Church of Christ, it's also called the Church of God, and it's called the Church of the Firstborn, and it's called a bunch of other things. But we've got to have the right. So what we do in doing the marks of the church, we put up what we're doing as our church, and we say those are the marks. We shoot the arrow and then draw the circles, the target around it. Why do we ignore the very thing that Jesus said was the mark of the true church? He says that the mark of the true church is what? Loving one. This is how people will know that you're the right church, if you love one another. Is it too much of a logistical stretch to say, when we don't love each other, that shows what? By this, all one people will know that you're my disciples, if you love one another. Here is the song that I started to say that we sang. This was what the altos sang, right? So some of us sang it. The rest of us, some of us just sat there really confused. No. Actually, this song is a lot easier for me to sing now than it used to be, because I don't hear anybody. I just hear myself. So all those other parts are kind of filtered out by my fancy hearing. Here's what John says. Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. If we don't reflect, you know, he's going to say a lot of different things in making this point, but jump down to verse 12, he says this, no one has ever seen God, But if we love one another, God lives in us, and His love is made complete in us. God lives in us. I got that in green because this is kind of interesting. The only time that I know of, there's probably plenty of other times, I just don't know of them, that the King James and the Message agree with each other. Both those translations has dwells. Or actually, the King James has dwelleth, but it's the same thing. In other words, it's not just lives, because you know you can live in your house, but be gone most of the time. But dwells, some of the other translation, abides. Anybody else thinking about the dude abides, you know, that sort of thing. He's there. He's not going anywhere. He lives in us. He dwells in us. He abides in us. If we love one another. What about if we don't? You see the point that he's making here. No one has ever seen God, but what did they see when there is a loving group of Christians getting along in unity and peace? That is our glimpse of heaven. That is how God is seen on earth. It's not only about love. The second thing, I said there was two things. The first is love, if we're going to replicate the fellowship of the New Testament. The second is the next step, and that is unity. We are to live together. I mean, the early church was devoted to that, right? In Acts 2 and verse 44, all the believers were together, and they had everything in common. And more to the point, in chapter 4, verse 32, all the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed any of their possessions as their own, but they shared everything as they had. You see, the early church was marked by love, but it wasn't a love that just talked. It was a love that acted. Because, you know, sometimes I think that we make love a little less than like. You know, Paul said the greatest of these is love, but we act like love's no big thing because we find ourselves saying things like this. Have you ever heard this? Maybe you've said it. We say, well, you know, I love them and all that, but I don't really like him or her very much. They're just hard to get along with. Now, understand, I don't mean them any harm. I would probably throw water on them if they caught fire, but I just don't like to be in the same room. I mean, think about that. What is that saying? It's saying it takes more courage, it takes more godliness, it takes more commitment to like somebody than it does to love them. Because you see, when we say that, what we're saying is, I got to love them because I have to. I don't really, but I'm going to say that I love them, but I don't like them. Well, that's not the kind of love that the Bible talks about as love. In fact, put it this way. Jesus says, Luke 6, love your enemies. Love your enemies? Yeah, love your enemies. Well, Jesus, what exactly do you mean by that? Well, I mean, do good to those who harm you or hate you. Bless those who curse you. And pray for those who mistreat you. So what is he saying? He's saying, you know what? Don't hate your enemies. Love your enemies. And by love, I mean treat them like they're your friends. We do those things to people that we like. So in other words, love acts like it likes. It might not have the emotion to go along with it. You know, we give them something to eat. It may be, well, here, have this. You know, we're making ourselves do the right thing. But he's saying that actual love has the actions that. Now, if we're supposed to love our enemies like that, what about brothers and sisters in Christ? Shouldn't there be something that goes along with action that goes, that we don't just say, yeah, I love all my Christian brothers and sisters. I really love, what's his name? You know, I just was talking to him 2 months ago, and I really think he's a good guy. You know, we've accepted something very much less than fellowship as New Testament fellowship. If you look closely at what Jesus says, we are to love because God loved us. And that love of us is unconditional and is filled with the greatest act of love ever, the cross. And then that's how we are to love each other. Here's the prayer that Jesus prays in John 17. We know that Jesus prayed in Gethsemane and God didn't answer his prayer. God answered his prayer, God just said no. But there's another unanswered prayer in Gethsemane. And it's the one that John covers before Jesus gets to the point where he takes his apostles and they fall asleep and all of that. And here's what his prayer is. He said, he's talking to God on the eve of his betrayal and condemnation and crucifixion. And his prayer is this. My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one. Father, just as you are in me and I am in you, may we also be in us so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one. You see the point that Jesus is asking for here? I in them and you in me. So that they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved me even as, loved them even as you've loved me. Now, Jesus is saying that there is a unity that exists between he and the Father. In fact, he's telling us that there is, we need to be unified for two different reasons. The first is theological. That he and the Father are one, and now we have been brought into that fellowship. Well, if God is one, and Christ is one, and now I am one, and you are one, what does that say about me and you? We're one too, right? It is a theological statement that those that are brought into Christ are one in Christ. That is a proclamation of God's unity when we live out that unity on earth. But there's a second consideration, and that is twice in this context, he says, that they may be one, so the world will know that you sent me. There's an evangelistic statement that is made here. We practice unity and love to one another so that the world will know that the message of the gospel is true, that Jesus is Lord and that God is God. Am I the only one that kind of feels like we're falling down on our end of the deal there? We are to be one as Christ and the Father are one. We live in a time that is as divided as it ever has been in our country, I feel. We are divided politically. Politics used to be the art of the possible. It used to be about compromise, about me scratch your back, I'll scratch yours, about, okay, I'll give you a little of this in this bill and you give me a little in that bill. We'll both be unhappy, but we're equally unhappy, and things get done. But now in our world, politics is winning. It's about enforcing your will over the opponent. It's about sound bites. It's about screaming either on cable news or screaming on Twitter that you're right and everybody else has to bow down. You got to choose sides. It's not about compromise. Compromise is seen as losing. We're as divided racially as we have ever been. We may have more avenues available to more people, but really equality. It's a time when Black Lives Matter collides with white privilege. We don't try to understand other people's views. We don't try to understand that they're coming from a different place. We don't try to walk a mile in their shoes. We want to beat them over the head with their shoe. They're either too racist or too liberal or too bigoted or too socialist, just too wrong. And we see that in the world all around us all the time. What if there was a place where everybody was accepted equally? What if there was a place where people got along despite their very differences and had different ideas about things, but all were accepted on the basis that we are all one in Christ? Wouldn't you want to be a part of that kind of place? Wouldn't the world want to be part of that kind of place? We're supposed to be that place. And if we're not living together in love and unity, then we have no right to talk about being the church of the New Testament. That was the driving power that made that church grow and fill the earth. And that's to be the same power that drives us today. Let's pray together.